From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In a recent interview with the Toledo Blade and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, President Obama said that today's media is filled with too much blogosphere, too much opinion, and too few facts. Many in the blogosphere were none too thrilled to read that. Obama said he'd be, quote, happy to look at legislation that would aid newspapers. Sounds noncommittal, but it got a lot of attention. Everyone wondered, are newspapers going to get a bailout? CNN's Wolf Blitzer and Jack Cafferty perfectly captured the reaction from the newspaper industry.
None of us who are journalists want to see the government get involved and become the publisher of newspapers.
No, that would be a no.
Yeah.
On Thursday, the Congressional Joint Economic Committee held hearings on the future of print. Representative Kevin Brady, Republican from Texas, expressed concern about the watchdogs of government relying on help from government.
When you feel like you're drowning, every lifeline looks good, but you have to be careful whose boat you're being pulled into. And if it's the government's boat, you know, there's real repercussions to that from your standpoint as well. I think we all recognize that.
The Newspaper Revitalization Act, introduced last March in the Senate, would give newspapers that regularly publish local, national, and international news the option of becoming tax-exempt nonprofits. Senator Ben Cardin, a Maryland Democrat, sponsored the bill. He says that the many problems at his local paper, the Baltimore Sun, inspired him.
Clearly, the Baltimore Sun, its parent company, is in serious trouble. The local bureaus have been reduced dramatically. You look at the number of articles, and it's dramatically reduced. You look at oversight that you would like to see, not just on your elected officials, but on your business leaders, or what's happening in the commercial centers, or what's happening in our schools, or what's happening in our health centers. All that has been very much reduced, not just in Baltimore, but around our country.
Some people have called your legislation a bailout for newspapers.
I would very much oppose any government bailout of newspapers. Newspapers need to maintain their independence. This is no different than allowing a newspaper to use the same type of a nonprofit status as a church can use or a school can use. I might just point out that most newspapers today are not making a profit. So in reality, they are nonprofit.
In your list of nonprofit organizations, you left out public broadcasting. Slate's media correspondent Jack Schaefer recently wrote, quote, "The last thing newspapers need is the sort of help from the government that turns them into NPR, endlessly begging for contributions, pursuing wealthy philanthropists, and standing in line for government handouts."
NPR has a very important, valuable role in our community, and we're very fortunate to have the quality of programming that we have by NPR. I am not trying to duplicate that model. I'm not trying to develop a public newspaper. I'm trying to develop a private newspaper that can have the type of revenue flow to maintain that independence. Quite frankly, I think a community should be able to contribute to their newspaper. It is a public service that's being provided by papers. They shouldn't have to look to a bottom line profit.
Well, Senator Cardin, here's the thing. We've talked to publishers and editors. We've read lots of editorials about your bill. And I think we can sum up the general response with a headline from the Delaware County Daily Times. Thanks, but no thanks.
They don't want it. They won't use it. This will not be for all papers. Let me make that clear. This is voluntary. You don't have to use this model. The interesting thing, as I explain what I'm trying to do, many of the people who initially had a knee-jerk reaction against the bill, thinking it was some form of government bailout, say, gee, this makes sense. That this, if a community wants to contribute, why shouldn't they be able to?
Here's where the rubber hits the road for most editors. Even those who can see a potential in nonprofit status, they can't swallow the fact that under your bill, their editorial pages would no longer be able to make political endorsements. Any newspaper would generally look at their elected representatives and evaluate their performances in advance of elections.
They can get involved as far as evaluating candidates. They can editorialize. The one thing they can't do, and a nonprofit can't do this, is directly endorse a candidate. And quite frankly, I think that's a relatively minor role considering the importance of our newspapers today.
It is true that when it comes to national elections, endorsements don't matter so much. But when it comes to local elections, state elections, newspaper endorsements are a huge source of guidance for voters.
Well, we might want to test that theory. I'm not sure that's totally accurate, but I wanted to make it clear it does not prevent them from editorializing. The only thing they cannot do is make a political endorsement.
Senator, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Senator Ben Cardin is a Democrat from Maryland. Jim Maroney is the publisher of the Dallas Morning News. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
So how important are political endorsements for your paper?
I think they're very important, particularly when you get into state and then local races. For instance, we wrote recommendations in the general election for over 40 different candidates, most of whom, of course, were local. And I talk to people all the time who tell me that I take what you published and it becomes my voting guide.
So the endorsement clause is the killer issue for you in Cardin's Newspaper Revitalization Act?
That, to me, would be an unacceptable element if, for any reason, I thought the best thing for this company to do would be to become nonprofit.
So if people could contribute to you and get a tax deduction thereby, but your ability to endorse would be unaffected, that would be fine?
That would be fine. I think we've got to at least explore these things to be sure that we take every opportunity to preserve the scale of journalism that newspaper companies are providing to our country today.
How's the Dallas Morning News doing?
We are profitable, have remained profitable, and basically have no debt, so we're in great shape.
So what makes you so great?
We have continued to protect as much of our scale of journalists and journalistic resources in this market, adding pages to the paper instead of taking them out. One of the things that we have done is we have gone to our customers and said, look, we need to ask you to pay a greater proportion of the cost of publishing and distributing a newspaper to your home. In so doing, we've reduced our dependency on advertising. The typical model for newspapers has been 80% advertising and 20% revenue from the people who buy the paper. By this time next year, we'll be something closer to 60-40, maybe even 55-45. To date, we're about 80% through all of our renewals, and 92% of our subscribers have agreed to pay a higher price, and I'm very proud of that. And I don't think we could have done it had we continued to cut our newsroom or continued to cut pages out of the paper.
You know, there's something that I forgot to do when we have conversations like this.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Jim, thank you very much.
And thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Jim Maroney is the publisher of the Dallas Morning News. The newspaper biz lost one of its greats last week. W. Horace Carter, longtime editor and publisher of the small-town North Carolina Tabor City Tribune. In 1953, Carter won a Pulitzer Prize for stories and editorials he'd written about the Ku Klux Klan then terrorizing the area. His meticulous reporting on local Klan wrongdoing eventually drew the FBI to the region and culminated in federal and state prosecutions of several dozen Klansmen. The Pulitzer Committee wrote that Carter's work, along with that of Willard Cole, another local publisher, frustrated the Klan's expansion efforts in the Carolinas. Walt Campbell is in the process of making a documentary about Carter's life, and he describes what Carter brought upon himself for standing up to the Klan.
They would call up and say, well, we're going to come and get you and your family tonight. We're going to attack your home. There were people who would park out in front of their home and shine the lights inside of their living room and just sit there for hours at a time. There were times when his dogs were kidnapped and killed.
Carter even faced resistance from his own family and friends. Here's Carter in his own words.
Some of the best friends I had in the world said, you're going to get in a lot of trouble if you keep on writing this stuff. Don't you know that they did the South a favor after the Civil War and you hadn't ought to be riding these people. They're trying to make this a better place to live.
The prevailing opinion in textbooks and other things was that the Klan had done the South a favor following the Civil War by coming out and routing out the carpetbaggers and the scallywags. And his father shared many of these same assumptions about the Klan. And for the most part, the surrounding population of the entire South felt that way about the Klan.
Carter started reporting on the Klan after they paraded through Tabor City in 1950. Can you describe that scene and how it played out?
It was a Saturday night. Mr. Carter had been warned, if you will, that something was going to happen that night and that he should be downtown about dark. Well, he heard a siren about 6 or 7 o'clock at night, and he went out, and he saw a line of cars coming through the center of Tabor City. The Klansmen had on their robes and hoods. Tabor City was a center for the surrounding community of farmers, and they would come in on Saturday night. So that was a good time for the Klan to catch them there. They had a little money in their pockets. They might want to take out a membership in the Klan. And they quickly paraded through town, threw out some literature on the sidewalk, and went through the black area of town known as the Bottom. Horace Carter saw that, and the next day he sat down, drafted an editorial, which came out in the next Wednesday's newspaper.
Can you read a salient line or two from that editorial?
The Klan, despite its Americanism, plea, is the personification of fascism and Nazism. It is just such outside-the-law operations that lead to dictatorships through fear and insecurity.
What was his reaction to winning the Pulitzer?
He was happy, of course. But I still think he felt of himself as having not done anything another newspaper editor wouldn't do. There was much made of it around the country and much made of him and his stance, and he handled it like the working-class Southern boy that he was.
Walt, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Walter Campbell is a scholar, author, and independent filmmaker. W. Horace Carter, publisher and editor of the Tabor City Tribune, died September 16th at the age of 88, not far from Tabor City, North Carolina.
I just believe, as I have told many people, that I did what any weekly newspaper would do if he was a Christian and he was trying to do the right thing and trying to raise a family in this community. I believe anybody would have done the same thing I did.
Coming up, can Netflix crush cable?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Wednesday, Attorney General Eric Holder unveiled a plan to reform the state secrets privilege. That's the mechanism whereby governments quash court cases by arguing that a trial would threaten national security. Judges will almost always defer to the government, and citizens have no way of knowing whether our security is really at risk or if the government is just sweeping embarrassments under a national security rug. Even though candidate Obama campaigned against the state secrets privilege, he has invoked it as president at least three times. In response, Senators Patrick Leahy and Russ Feingold proposed legislation to help guide the courts when deciding whether the state secrets privilege should prevail. So it's good news that the White House has introduced its own set of reforms, right? Not necessarily. Civil rights attorney Jonathan Turley has confronted the state secrets privilege in court numerous times. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So why don't we begin by telling me why the good news isn't so fantastic after all?
Well, to be fair to the administration, the reforms do add some procedures, largely internal. But they're primarily saying that the administration is going to be more cautious in using it, have more people look at the invocation of privilege, and try not to use it when they don't have to. What it's missing is the type of substance that's contained in the legislation that was drafted by Senators Leahy and Feingold. And specifically, that legislation tries to create actual standards to have federal courts look at these invocations and make independent decisions. Under the Obama proposal, it's pretty much still the federal government that when they make this type of invocation, it largely has to be accepted by the court without much review. That's the problem.
So in effect, the Obama administration is saying, yeah, we understand this rule has been abused in the past, but trust us.
It is very much trust us, we're the government. There's a great suspicion that this proposal is really an effort by the Justice Department to preempt the legislation in Congress. For the first time in my lifetime, there is a majority in Congress that seems close to passing legislation. And I think that the Department of Justice has been counting heads, and they don't want this legislation to pass because it contains real standards. It allows a judge to actually make an independent decision.
The CBS headline on the story was Holder Changes State Secret Policy. The New York Times said, Justice Department to Limit Use of State Secrets Privilege. I understand it's your impression that the press has kind of laid down on this and are being far less aggressive with this Justice Department than they would have been with the Bush Justice Department issuing a similar policy.
If George Bush had proposed this type of change, then the newspapers would have been all over it, asking experts, people who've litigated in this area, whether this is a real change, whether this is substantive, and more importantly, what was left out. What you saw here, as we've seen in other cases, like the torture area, is that the media immediately picks up with the White House spin. There's very little effort to look at what of substance is here and what is not here. And when you look at it, you realize that this is a bit of a Potemkin village. It has all of the facade of procedures, but not much of the depth. Reporters did, I thought, a very fine job in questioning the Bush administration about whether fine-sounding words actually had equally fine substance. But none of that has occurred here. The media is just assuming that President Obama is on the side of the angels.
If you're right in your analysis, why would Obama, upon ascending to the presidency, turn his back on his campaign promises? And maybe more to the point, why would he behave like previous administrations have on questions of national security?
Oh, well, this is nothing new for civil libertarians. I mean, we are always the bridesmaid and never the bride in these new administrations. Presidents, particularly Democrats, often curry the favor of civil libertarians and express their belief in these core principles that must be protected. When they get into office, the first thing they do is they tend to throw those promises to the side. And the answer is quite clear. It's politics. The Obama White House knows that civil libertarians have nowhere to go and that even if they don't fulfill their promises, they're unlikely to vote for the next Republican nominee. More importantly, the Obama administration has clearly worked to establish Obama as tough on national security. They're very concerned that another terrorist attack could be blamed on any changes that they make. So there really is no downside for being tough on national security and being less protective over civil liberties.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Turley is a professor of law at George Washington University.
At his speech at the Brookings Institution, FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski proposed formalizing the rules to ensure that internet service providers treat all content providers equally. In other words, whether you drive a Prius or a road-hogging Hummer on the information superhighway, the people who own the roads can't charge you different rates for different speeds. Or, more to the point, whether you are the Goliath called Google or a teenager called, I don't know, Spike, you'll pay the same price for service. And Jenikowski also proposed broadening the so-called net neutrality rules to include not just home broadband providers like cable companies, but wireless carriers as well, like phone companies. Jenikowski says that net neutrality will ensure that ISPs can't quash competition, give preferential treatment to friends, or secretly mess with your service, which has happened before.
Making sure that both wired and wireless providers have the reasonable ability to manage their networks is important. It's important because those companies need to be incentivized to invest in their networks, to make the pipes bigger and more robust. Our job is to make sure that as they do that, the internet remain open.
Without compromising any individual innovators' access to the same speed and the same advantages of the big guys.
Well, net neutrality is a set of principles around fair rules of the road that preserve equal access to the internet so that any innovator has the same chance to come up with an idea, start a business, put it on the internet, and succeed.
Let's say AT&T and Apple want to keep Google Voice, which is a competitive service, free texting and cheap international calls, off the iPhones. And the reason that they give is that it consumes too much network space. It's probably a pretty good reason, given how much spectrum is taken up by the iPhone. On the other hand, it's an awfully suspicious reason, because this is a competitive service. It strikes me that in your approach to network neutrality, you're very much concerned that competitive services get a fair shake, but there doesn't seem to be much here that can ensure that the pipelines are going to get any bigger. What are you going to do about the clogging?
So there are a couple of points. One is we may very well need to identify more spectrum to be put to use for the wireless industry. And that's something that we're working on at the FCC. The second thing is we are looking to find ways to incentivize more efficient use of the spectrum so that you can actually put more water through the same pipe. We've seen improvements in spectrum efficiency over the years. We're looking to find ways to accelerate spectrum efficiency because we know that the demands on our spectrum are going to grow and grow and grow.
What's wrong with charging Google more than some little guy?
Well, the important thing is that any business models that are put in place give everyone an equal chance to compete on the platform. We need to have experimentation around business models that encourage investment in the wireless network and in the wired network. We also need to have an open platform that encourages the broadest range of competition and entrepreneurial activity.
The point is to make sure that other Googles can emerge. But once they become Google, why can't you give them a bill?
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. We're, you know, at this stage of the game, we've announced that in October, we will begin an open process where all stakeholders will have a chance to participate. People can participate in it at openinternet.gov, and we'll have other ways to engage ideas and talk about specific examples, but we haven't started the proceeding yet. That will start next month, and that'll be the venue for an open, vibrant, intensive exchange of ideas over what kind of rules of the road would best serve America's interests.
Thank you very much.
Brooke, thank you.
FCC Chairman Julius Jenikowski.
Last year, Netflix spent about a quarter of its $1.4 billion of revenue sending little red DVD envelopes back and forth through the mail. That's why it would rather stream movies directly to your computer, a service it now offers for a limited number of titles. But most people don't like watching movies on their computers, and feeding a film from a computer to a TV is possible, but kind of complicated. So Netflix made deals with Samsung and Microsoft and LG to put Netflix's software into game consoles and TVs and DVD players to make it absurdly easy for you to stream one of its movies directly onto your flat screen. It's far cheaper for Netflix, no postage, more convenient for you, no waiting, and terrifying for the cable companies, which are also in the business of delivering movies to your TV. As reporter Daniel Roth explains in the October issue of Wired, if Netflix can cut the same content deals with Hollywood as Comcast and Time Warner have, this could be the beginning of the end for the cable companies.
The entire entertainment industry is built around the idea that you won't be able to go around your cable company. Everyone from Hollywood to Comcast to Cox to Time Warner Cable, they all depend on getting that beautiful monthly subscription bill that you and I pay every month and think there's no other way around it except to pay it. What Netflix is doing is figuring out a way around that.
Let's talk about the Hollywood studios for a moment. They have this very sweet arrangement where they premiere a movie theatrically, and then after its run, there will be a window for pay-per-view, and then there'll be DVD release and airlines, and I'm not sure exactly the order that these windows open. Netflix streaming of Hollywood films kind of cuts in to their window structure, does it not?
All that Hollywood cares about is just making sure they get paid as much as they can, as often as they can. And Netflix, by saying you only have to pay them $9 a month and you can watch as many movies as you want, it's not great for Hollywood. They don't like that kind of model.
They sell a la carte. Netflix is selling an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Exactly. So Netflix's way around this was that they went to a little pay TV channel called Stars. It's like an HBO or Showtime. And Netflix said, we are a distributor of content just like Cox's and just like Time Warner Cable is. Why don't you just start showing your movies over Netflix streaming, Netflix to people's TV? Stars looked at their contracts and said, you're right, we can do this. It was a total loophole. And now when you go on to Netflix, you can get a lot of near first run movies that Stars has access to that the movie studios never realized would be shown in this sort of on-demand, all-you-can-eat way that Netflix is doing it. They just snuck in through Stars window.
Now, I can just see the Fiji water just, you know, being crushed in the Hollywood executives' hands. I can just... How have they dealt with Netflix's ingenious little exploitation of that loophole?
My understanding is that they've gone back to Stars and said, this cannot happen again. And Netflix always knew that this was not a permanent solution. But they have used this time to go to Hollywood and say, we are willing to pay for these movies. Just slot us into your windows. And the more people that sign up for Netflix and the more that we can move people away from the Postal Service, all that money is going to be channeled to you, Hollywood. And Hollywood likes that storyline.
Cable companies are still enormous and they have a lot of clout in the marketplace. But if people stop paying the half or more than half of their cable bills that go towards TV programming, doesn't that pretty much, you know, at a minimum, cut the cable Goliath down to size?
Cable companies typically get about 60% of their revenue from the TV bill. If they lost that, they would be entirely different companies. They would be what in the industry they call dumb pipes, just deliverers of bits. That's the future we're talking about, taking this all the way to its logical end.
Daniel Roth is a senior reporter for Wired magazine. Ted Sarandos is chief content officer for Netflix. Ted, welcome to OTM.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So to hear Dan Roth tell it, Netflix is going to take over the world and unseat cable and change the landscape for movies and other video entirely.
Well, people who own content, the people who own distribution, like the status quo. But at the end of the day, satellite, telco, cable, VHS tapes, DVDs, video on demand, all of these things have done nothing but grow the consumer appetite and consumption of films entertainment.
I don't think that Hollywood has much to fear. They just have a different distribution channel.
Right.
I'm a little concerned about the other distribution channels, chief among them cable, which seems that given a service like yours is a kind of unnecessary middleman that charges a lot of money to be in the middle.
Well, you know, I think that the choices that consumers make around content, a big chunk of that has a lot to do with live television, with watching sports, watching news, watching water cooler content. Cable and broadcast television is really great at the, you know, kind of one-to-many broadcasting. And the internet is superior mostly at the one-to-one piece. And at the prices that Netflix offer this all this great content, you really don't have to cancel too many things in your spending to fit us in.
Tell me if I'm wrong. I'm hearing resistance to the notion that somehow the cable business model is in jeopardy at your hands. And yet you haven't really told me why they shouldn't be scared out of their wits. I don't know that live sports and the occasional awards ceremony is going to be enough to keep broadcast and cable TV alive, especially if live sports start selling directly to the consumer too, as I expect the NFL and Major League Baseball will continue to do
sure.
as much as they can.
Well, why I think we fit nicely in the ecosystem instead of destroying the ecosystem is the percentage of consumers in America who are watching content online has doubled over the last 2 years. That's from Pew Internet. And if you look at that, you should see some deterioration in linear television. And in fact, at the last reporting, linear television hours are actually up a little bit. As an example, as part of your Netflix subscription, you have access to practically the entire primetime lineup of the Disney Channel. Everything that's on the air on Disney, the next day you can watch it on Netflix. We've had that for over a year, and on the most recent rating period, the Disney Channel ratings are up 11%. So that tells me that there is a big segment of the population that values that content delivery system differently than they value us. There's one catchphrase you hear around the cable world called the massive passives, which is this gigantic population of people that just want to sit down and scroll and find something and watch it. And the on-demand universe does nothing to address that.
I mean, the reason we're having this conversation is we felt that you guys were nervous that Dan Roth had overstated the case, that he had pitted you against cable in a way that you don't think you are, in fact.
Correct. And by the way, I mean, he'll get that impression from talking to cable operators and content owners, too. And then I heard Leslie Moonves just about 6 months ago say that the DVR is going to be the savior of network television. I mean, this is a device that, you know, less than 2 years ago, everyone was suing to try to stop. So what I challenge content owners and cable satellite executives to think about is, what are the things that they're going to be talking about as positive 2 years from now that they're trying to kill today?
Ted Sarandos is Chief Content Officer for Netflix.
Coming up, why Detroit has become a media magnet.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Detroit has been slammed by our current economic woes. Actually, it was slammed before our current economic woes. Its unemployment rate is more than double the national average. And over the past 60 years, its population has shriveled from nearly 2 million to roughly half of that. And it's still shriveling. The recession, pervasive as it is, can be maddeningly tough to document, especially for photojournalists. You can't take a picture of the GDP. But Detroit, with its shuttered factories and empty train stations, is chock full of potent pictures of decline. Problem is, some of those pictures are pretty misleading. Vice magazine's Thomas Morton recently asked a local photographer to take him on a tour of Detroit's most photographed icons of decay for a feature on what he calls ruin porn. At one site in particular, Morton noticed that photographers were essentially cropping out the adjacent prosperity.
And so he took us on top of this mound where he had taken one of the pictures that really, really evokes this desolation. But if you tilt the camera even just like a little bit to the right or to the left, on one side, there's this really well-kept food factory building with nicely manicured lawn out front. And the other way, there's an office building that when we were there, everybody was out like eating their lunch. It was bustling. There was all this activity.
A wider shot would have spoiled the mood, eh?
That is true. Michigan Grand Central Terminal, which is a huge, dilapidated old train station. It's been that way since the 80s, and there's been a lot of pictures of it, but it's kind of considered like an iconic shot to be matched up with the current stories about the bottom falling out of the automotive industry and such. But it's just, it's disingenuous. It's like going to the base of Roosevelt Island and taking pictures of the old mental hospital from the 50s to underscore some point about Obamacare.
You singled out one publication for particular disdain, and that was Time magazine.
Our photographer told us he'd been called up by this reporter from Time and realized when he went to pick him up, he'd been dropped off in the city, basically, and he was only there. He had to be back in like 8 hours, and they expected him to, you know, be able to get the feel of the city in that little eight-hour span. Within the course of 2 months, they ran a pair of photo essays about Detroit's desolation. The first of which was called The Remains of Detroit, and it featured, I think, 10 or 11 pictures that were all from just three or four sites, and they were the big ones, the ones you always see. There was the Packard Auto plant.
Well, wait, that's a good one because it's an abandoned automotive plant, so that should be a perfectly legitimate symbol for the destruction of a city in progress, right?
The only problem is it was shut down in 1957 and hasn't been open since.
Okay, so they're a little bit late on the Packard closing.
Yep.
What are the other usual venues for these documents of despair?
The three big ones is featured prominently in this Time photo essay. There are the Packard plant. There's the Fisher body plant, which has been shut down a while. I don't think as long as the Packard plant. And then there's the train station, which has been shut down since the 80s. But what was interesting about it was what they did with the Packard plant and the Fisher plant. There would be one picture that was an interior, and it would say Packard Auto plant. And the caption would explain what the photo was. And then there would be another one that was taken right outside the Packard Auto plant. But instead of referencing the plant, it would say Bellevue Avenue, which is where the Packard Auto plant is located. And then they repeated that at the Fisher body plant went outside. And it was still a shot of the plant, but it says Hastings Avenue.
Creating the illusion that there is at least twice as much urban devastation.
And creating the illusion that their photographer went to twice as many sites as he actually did.
But if a reporter were caught repeatedly leaving out key facts that changed the context of, let's say, a direct quote, or otherwise manipulating reality in a story, he wouldn't be long for his job, or she.
I think when you're presented with a photo and then a little bit of description of it, the image stands so strongly that it's almost hard to argue with. You're throwing what seem like minor quibbles at this shot of utter desolation.
Do you have any thoughts as to what compels us as humans to be so fascinated with this kind of documentary photography? Is it rubbernecking, like as if you're passing the scene of a car crash?
A little bit. I think people just like a good ruin. I mean, setting aside like any kind of like deep philosophical implications of it, it's just people like a good smashed up thing. I know I do.
All right, Thomas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Morton wrote about desolation porn for Vice.
Assignment Detroit could be seen as a corrective to the criticisms of Thomas Morton. It's a year-long project of Time magazine and a half dozen other outlets, including Fortune, Sports Illustrated, and CNN Money. Time magazine bought a six-bedroom house that will act as the command center for the journalists and also Time correspondent Stephen Gray, who will live there for the next year and anchor the coverage. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brooke.
So what are you going to do with the six bedrooms? Is Fortune staying in one and Sports Illustrated in another? It sounds like a sitcom.
Basically, here's how it works. I mean, I am the guy who pretty much I manage the house in terms of making sure that there's adequate food in the house for the different correspondents or editors who will be rotating in addition to doing the job of simply covering the region, right, the main journalism. So it's kind of juggling both hats, almost like a bureau chief in the old school journalism days.
You've parachuted into Detroit for one or two day assignments in the past.
Yeah, I'd been here once to do a story on Kwame Kilpatrick back in September of 2007. And then the following month, I came back to do a story on an Arab American conference in the run-up to the presidential primaries. In the case of the Kwame Kilpatrick profile, I was here for less than 6 hours. In the case of the Arab American conference, I was here for, you know, a day and a half. It's really hard to even understand what makes a region or a community tick in that short time frame. I think that having the house near downtown Detroit gives us a much more nuanced perspective about what makes Detroit, Michigan, and the region tick. And that's partly because we're interacting. We hear tidbits of information from neighbors. We're able to go out and talk with city officials and city business leaders and a range of other community residents in a way that you could not in a six-hour time frame where you're rushing to get back from the airport to talk to your sources and then get back to the airport only to hop to the next story.
In your blog, you say that some of your key questions will be, what will it take for Detroit and the region to rebound, and who's developing the ideas that are best positioned to make that turnaround succeed? What happens if you don't find answers to those questions over the course of this year?
I think we already have. There are people here who are actively engaged in turning this region around, and we will call it as we see it. We can't run away from the region's problems and writing about some of those problems, but I'm far more interested in, and I think our audience, in fact, I'm certain that our audience is far more interested in hearing about problem solvers and solutions than they are hearing about the same sort of stories we've heard the last, 40 to 50 years.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Brooke. Pleasure.
Stephen Gray is a correspondent for Time magazine. Daniel Okrent is also writing for Time magazine right now. He's a longtime journalist and author and a visiting lecturer at the Shorenstein Center for the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. His cover story on Detroit for Time hits the stands this week. He says that year-long reporting projects are rare indeed.
We respond to the thing that happened today or that is going to happen tomorrow. It's very rare that the American news media get into long considerations of stories that have unrolled, or in this case, unraveled over a long period of time.
There's something called narrative bias in journalism, a desire to see an arc to a story, maybe look for a happy ending. Once you have devoted a year to a project like this, do you worry about narrative bias, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. I think that in this case, the likelihood of that setting in is slighter than it usually is because so many different sensibilities and different magazines are involved in it. If it were just me going to Detroit and then working a story out over time, spinning it forward, I could see how I or any reporter would risk the narrative bias. But you're going to have probably 20 different writers representing four different magazines and four different websites, and we're going to contradict each other if we're doing our jobs.
I know someone who covers Afghanistan for a website. Mm-hmm. He writes about a wide variety of subjects, but when he writes about Afghanistan, the numbers of readers really drops. My question is, by flooding the zone in Detroit the way that Time intends to, do you think you can make America pay attention, not just by quality, but by volume?
No, I don't think so. There is no question that there can be a reader fatigue on any subject, but if you start with 10 million readers and you end up with only a million, you've still done pretty damn well. The other thing is I think that the different approaches, different stories in Detroit. So if you look at this week's Sports Illustrated, it's a cover story about the Detroit Tigers, which has nothing to do with what I'm writing about and nothing to do with the cover story in Fortune about General Motors. So there are many different ways for the reader as well as for these magazines and reporters to come at it.
But if we're only interested in the Tigers, or if we're only interested in the auto industry, and we read those stories, can we still learn something about the larger Detroit?
I certainly hope so. And I would hope that we all do our jobs well enough so that there is a larger truth to be discovered in covering the various pieces of the story. Now, can that be applied to cities that have suffered a similar industrial and economic decline? I don't know. But if we do our jobs well, we may find out. And if we do find out, maybe there are lessons to be drawn that can halt this decline in those places.
Daniel, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Daniel Okrent is a visiting lecturer at the Shorenstein Center's John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And his cover story on Detroit for Time magazine is on newsstands this week.
That's the sound of the film Winged Migration, a documentary that followed migratory birds. The film would lead you to believe that we were seeing those birds in the wild, but despite the title and the footage, all is not as it seems to be. We'll be returning to that a little later. These are fertile times for documentaries. They've exploded onto screens, both large and small, and mostly we trust documentaries to portray more or less the truth. But who ensures that films hew close to the reality they claim to depict? Right now, it's individual filmmakers working alone without clear guidelines and with only their consciences as their guides. Patricia Alfterheide, a professor at American University's Center for Social Media, says this approach leads to a kind of slippery slope.
When the civil rights documentary Mighty Times was produced, there was a whole segment of supposedly archival footage that was actually reenacted. There's a recent film called Bananas about the Dole Company's poor treatment of workers in Guatemala. And one of the lead characters in there turns out to not be what he claimed to be and to have given erroneous information.
When the ethical breaches came to light, they caused minor scandals in the documentary world. And the suspicion that there had to be many more such ethical breaches has spooked the documentary community into creating its own ethical standards and practices. First step, after Haida and two other colleagues interviewed 45 doc filmmakers anonymously in order to find out just how gray the gray areas actually are. Turns out they were very, very, very gray.
On a nature shoot, the cable company in question had given the crew a very short amount of time to film a predator capturing prey. And the prey in question was a rabbit, and unbeknownst to the director, the animal wrangler had actually broken the leg of a rabbit in order to let the predator capture it. And they had one more shot to do. It's getting dusk, and the wrangler then turns to the director and says, "Do you want me to break the leg of this one too?" And the director suddenly has to make a choice. And with some great soul-searching says, "Yeah, go ahead." One filmmaker who was dealing with a subject whose family had all died and he didn't have any family photographs, the filmmaker went to a flea market, found some old photographs of some other family that was from the right era and the right demographic, and just slotted them in. And he said, "I'm sure 99% of the people who watched that movie thought that that was his family, and I'm not going to disabuse him, and I don't think it makes any real difference."
I was shocked. I mean, shocked, shocked, shocked to look at your study and see the examples of the way filmmakers play fast and loose with the truth in order to tell what they think is a larger story. Do they really think that telling small lies is all right if it serves a larger truth?
You are never simply delivering it to people unfiltered. You always have to make choices. You're always going to have to alter the chronological sequence in some way. You are always going to have to make tough decisions about whose story to tell. All of those things have to be owned. And so I think what people say is, I have to stay in a good faith relationship with my subjects and tell the truth to the viewer. And the problem here is that sometimes you cannot tell the truth to the viewer without in some way violating the trust of the subject. But the problem for them is that they're operating in a lonely, isolated environment when they make those decisions, and they are operating without ever having collectively clarified what those values are. Inevitably, ethical values always come into conflict with each other. It's the nature of things.
I want to ask you about the most famous rabbit leg breaker, and that's Michael Moore. Now, early in his career, I was just absolutely in awe of this guy because of his ability to get the greatest imaginable tape that was hilarious and trenchant at the same time. And then, as I laughed through Roger and Me and then later Fahrenheit 9-1-1, I realized that part of his shtick was clearly to fiddle with chronology and context in order to get the most comedic or political oomph out of a given sequence. In other words, he cheats.
Mm-hmm.
How prevalent is that sort of cheating to make a point?
I think that most documentarians are absolutely worried about the Michael Moore approach because they feel that their work is then distrusted. And that's another case for why standards and practices are so important. One of the head people at the National Film Board of Canada said to me, "We need your study because people we interview don't trust us anymore." But Michael Moore is so unusual. The growth of documentary in theaters and on television has really been much more dependent on stuff like Spellbound, Winged Migration, March of the Penguins, which have other ethical issues. I mean, those penguins don't mate for life, by the way. So those are the middle-range documentaries that do depend on a good faith relationship with the audience and that do have difficult ethical questions about the way that they've been edited and told and narrated and structured that I think we're really concerned about.
Wow. You mean penguins are promiscuous?
Penguins tend to mate for a season. Yes, it's not the love story of all time. It's just the love story of the season. Sorry.
So has anyone had to answer for that? Like, for example, the producers of March of the Penguins?
No, they haven't. Winged Migration is another example of a documentary nature film. It's about migrating birds. It's not always clear to people who watch Winged Migration that they raised all of those birds, so that those birds are not raised in nature and merely caught by the amazing French team that photographed them. They were actually part of the family.
Well, I got more than I bargained for. I find that in both instances, those examples are extremely troubling. I don't ask you to speak for the documentarians themselves, but I am interested to know, you know, how bad you believe, as a scholar on the subject, that the problem is.
I think the problem is actually very big in the most formulaic and most commercial products. They're the documentaries that are being done on the lowest budgets, the stuff on the History Channel that asks, what was Atlantis really like? It is a big problem, but I think that the people we interviewed are part of the solution to the problem, because they are people whose work lives and dies on the reputation of them being honest and want desperately to articulate standards that can preserve and grow and nurture the reputation of documentary as an honest story about something real.
Patricia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Patricia Afterhaida is a professor at the Center for Social Media at American University and co-author of Honest Truths, Documentary Filmmakers on Ethical Challenges in Their Work.
The father and his chick sing to one another, making sure each knows the other's voice. It is the only way the two will find each other when the father returns.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Hover and Dan Mazzi, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.